This is Only a Game. I'm Karen Given. Monday should have been the 124th running of the Boston Marathon. 31,000 runners were registered to line up in Hopkinton for a start that would have sounded a lot like this. Instead, over this past weekend, one man, a writer, who's never before been a serious runner, stood outside his parents' home in Ann Arbor, Michigan, intending to run a marathon of his own.
4, 3, 2, 1, go.
He had no idea if anyone would come out to cheer him on, but he knew he had trained hard for this moment, and he wasn't going to let it pass him by. John Eubacon, welcome back to Only a Game.
Karen, thank you.
Okay, so let's actually start at the beginning of this story, and that's on the day of your 55th birthday. What did you discover on that day?
That was July 3rd of 2019. And what I discovered, Karen, since you had to ask, you put your feet in that scale and it flashes back 205. Now, to put this in context, I'm 5'8". That was 40 pounds over my coaching weight. Not my playing weight, Karen, my coaching weight. I was eating about as mindfully as a raccoon tearing through your garbage at midnight. On deadlines, and you know about those, of course,
Yeah. You
put some Diet Coke in a pack of Oreo Double Stuff or Haagen-Dazs or whatever else, and you pound that stuff because you can't take any breaks. This is not where you want to be, and that's where I was. And I've also got a 3-year-old kid at that point, so you realize, look, am I going to observe my kid growing up, or am I going to be part of that? You know, can I run with a kid? So this was a wake-up call.
So many people, when they hit their mid-50s, start to think that maybe they should take up cycling or yoga or something with less impact on the joints. What made you decide that this was the time to become a serious runner?
And they're right, by the way. I knew that I needed some crazy, scary goal to really motivate me. Daniel Burnham, the architect of Chicago, of course, in the 1890s, said, "Make no small plans. They lack the power to stir men's blood." And so I was going to scare the hell out of myself. And how best to do that than the world's greatest race, the Boston Marathon? Many far better athletes than I have fallen at that race. Let's do that. Why not?
I got to think, if I were going to pick something to be my first marathon, I think I would choose a race that doesn't have something called the Heartbreak Hill.
I didn't think it all the way through.
Okay, so you had some help getting ready for this big, scary goal. Tell me about those first few runs with Ron Warhurst. And first of all, we should probably mention that Ron is 76 years old.
That's right. Ronnie's a 2-time Purple Heart recipient from Vietnam. He volunteered for that after graduating from college. Started coaching Michigan in 1973, the cross-country team at the University of Michigan. 18 Big Ten titles in 40 years, and one of his star runners is Greg Meyer, the 1983 Boston Marathon champion. So I needed help, and I got grossly overqualified assistance.
So you got Ron, and you went running with Ron, and at first, did you have trouble keeping up with Ron?
Yes, I did. Ronnie is 21 years my senior, and he had to wait for me repeatedly, a 2-mile loop. I had to stop 2, 3, 4 times, walk, catch my breath, grab a tree. This was horrible. You would not have bet on me at this time, and many of my friends and my students at Michigan, I teach there on the side, they all pretty much bet against me doing this.
Well, over time, you lost weight, your runs got longer, they got faster. What did it feel like to actually be accomplishing this goal?
I gotta tell you, I could say in the first week, I'm in horrible shape, I've got a million bad habits, but I ran 3 times this week, 2 miles each. I am getting better. Ronnie Warhurst, man, God bless him. He said, man, don't focus on what anyone else is doing because everyone else out there is doing more than you are. Just put your shoes on. Everything else takes care of itself.
So you worked your way up to 20 miles. And then on March 13th, the Boston Marathon was postponed to September 14th due to the COVID-19 pandemic. That news couldn't have come as a surprise. But what was the most immediate emotion you felt when the announcement was made?
It was heartbreaking, truly, because there is nothing like Boston. I'm sorry. New York's great. Chicago's great. You know, Berlin and London and so on. But they're not Boston. So what do you do? Do you quit? Do you go back to eating double stuffs? And one look at the mirror, my wife and my son, I realize I cannot go back. I have to look forward, not backwards, but still, what do you do? And one of my runs through Ann Arbor, my hometown, it occurred to me, this is what I do. I'm going to start at my parents' house. I'm going to run past everything I care about, my junior high school and my favorite ponds and ballparks and you name it. I don't have, you know, 500,000 screaming spectators. The students at Wellesley are not going to kiss me. So what do you do? I needed these memories to keep me going, and I put the word out there, but I did not think anybody was going to show up.
Who and what were you expecting to find along the route?
Not much. I knew that a few of my friends were going to meet me at a few different junctures, hop on their bikes and be, you know, a safe distance apart. But that was 5 or 10 people in the course of 26 miles. And in my case, that's 5 hours, by the way.
One person per hour.
Not quite 500,000 spectators, is it? I hope they're loud and enthusiastic.
Well, I mean, yeah, were you worried about that? Because for a lot of people who run marathons, and Boston especially, it's the energy of the crowd that pushes them through.
Absolutely. Look, I've interviewed Bill Rogers at length, and Greg Meyer, of course, my coach, has told me all about it. And they said, look, don't worry about Heartbreak Hill. You'll never stop there. They will not let you. You know, you get past that, you're going to make it. So, yeah, I was uncertain at best.
All right, so take me to the start.
The starting line, we picked a strip of tar in a crack of the asphalt in front of my parents' house. My dad was in his car in the driveway to watch me with his mask on. My mom was in the on the street with her mask on. Neighbors came out with their masks on, all at the COVID spacing, of course. My wife was there with my son. A few friends showed up just to cheer me leaving, and a couple I know were there to run with me the first 4 or 5 miles or so.
All right, so tell me about some of the people you saw along the way.
It happened right away. Just running down the hill from my parents' house, about a quarter mile. One of my old buddies, Brian Wiseman, was there outside of his house, past the Benedict's house. They're in their 80s. My friend's parents, I spent countless sleepovers at that home. They've got a sign up there saying, "Go Nokabe Nodge." That's John Bacon backwards, which they called me 40 years ago. Have not heard that since. You know, a block later, Keith and Anita Severance. A block later, Paul and Michelle Barnett. And it just kept going like this. Ran up to Clegg Junior High School. Bob Cope was my baseball coach there. We've stayed in touch, but I hadn't seen him in years. He's got Alzheimer's. His wife is taking care of him. It's not too far yet. But we've been trying to get together for a few months now, actually. And, of course, the virus ended that. And as I'm running up, to Clegg Junior High School, I'm seeing Bob there with his wife, Lisa, and a sign, and he's not talking. But he's red-eyed, and now I'm red-eyed, and I stopped. And you can't get that in Boston.
Yeah.
But damn it, tell me now you're going to tell him at the end of the day that I didn't finish. You're going to finish. And that's mile 4 or 5. You can't stop now. You cannot stop.
Tell me about the people playing bagpipe music.
That was mile 24. I was okay through mile 20, doing about 11-minute miles, which for me is fine. After that, man, my left knee was hurting, my right hip was hurting. Every step is pound, pound, pound. It's just, you would not do this in any other situation, I don't think. You'd stop. I know they're going to be there. They told me they're going to be. This is Barney Klein, great friend of mine, who died last year at age 56 of pancreatic cancer, and I emceed his service. His wife is there with their 20-year-old and 17-year-old sons, and they're playing the bagpipes because that's what we always played for tailgates and so on at Barney's house. Barney loved them. We played those. The last time I heard them was Barney's funeral. So that gets you, and they also had laid out shots.
Want a shot?
Which we would normally drink on a tailgate. I said, no, thank you. There are a lot of reasons I might blow this in the last 2 miles, but that can't be one of them. But that, I mean, how does that not get you? And it hammers home, as corny as it sounds, this is a statement of life. We're not guaranteed anything. We know that now with all these COVID deaths and so on as we ever have. But, you know, Barney was a perfectly healthy guy, and he's gone at 56. So if you are alive, do something, man. Put the damn shoes on.
Let's go!
More cowbell!
Thank you. Now, look, Boston, of course, it's Hereford to Boylston, right? And it's famous. And I was looking forward to that. Well, in Ann Arbor, going Miller to Minor to Fountain is not quite the same. But when we made that final turn onto Fountain, the cowbell starts and you hear them. And I can see about 15, 20 friends spread out. A lot of folks in their car to be safe.
Oh, there it is. There it is.
And we hit it 15 feet before the finish line, which looks like toilet paper in the photos. Toilet paper is way too precious. It was drywall tape. And I can see my wife holding one half of the drywall tape. I see my son, and you know, I'm slogging along. My feet are barely leaving the ground. I'm technically running, I guess. But there it is. But there it is. Ah.
What did that moment mean to you?
It meant a lot more than I expected. You've changed your life. You've made a commitment to your family to do better and your friends. I was shocked to see so many people there, stunned that this mattered to them. That amidst all this bad news, my stupid stubbornness to keep going seemed to help people. And by the time we're done, we estimated we probably passed 100 people. I was expecting 5 or 10. Then you kind of realize just how thirsty everybody is right now for any good news, for any sense of connection. And as one of my friends pointed out, Adam was one of my former hockey players. He said, with all due respect, coach, you're the only game in town.
Hey, Daddy, let's do a longer run on the sidewalk.
You want to see this? Yeah, yeah. Ready, Teddy?
Yeah.
Oh!
He broke.
You started this whole thing so that you'd be healthy enough to play with your son. But when you crossed that finish line after 5.5 hours, you didn't have enough energy left to race him down the street. Have you recovered enough to keep up with a 4-year-old?
So he crushed me that first run. But I'm telling you this right now, Karen. 2 days after all this happened, we're running around the backyard exactly as I had dreamed a year ago. And doggone it, I not only beat him, he had to stop and catch his breath. So, hey. Score one for Daddy.
John U. Bacon is hoping to write a book about his marathon experience. And don't worry, he's not going back to eating double stuffs and sitting on the couch. And if the Boston Marathon grants him a bib number for September, John says he will run. The San Antonio Food Bank has been especially busy lately. So they turned to Spurs head coach Greg Popovich for a pep talk.
You know, he can be pretty hard-nosed and he can be pretty intimidating, but I think for that period of time, he just, you know, really leaned in.
That's coming up on Only a Game from NPR.
Want to add more positivity to your podcast feed? Check out Kind World, stories of extraordinary kindness and compassion.
That's Kind World. Subscribe now on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen.
I'm Karen Given. No one knows when or if the NBA season will resume, but coaches got a coach. And last week, San Antonio Spurs head coach Greg Popovich used his quite considerable skills to inspire a team that has nothing to do with sports. To talk about that, I'm joined by Eric Cooper, president and CEO of the San Antonio Food Bank. Hi, Eric.
Hey, Karen. Great to be on.
Okay, so to understand why your team was in need of inspiration, I want to go back to April 9th.
Thousands of families will end the day with full pantries if the San Antonio Food Bank has its way. It is holding another mega food distribution event today, the largest one so far. And as Katrina,
according to news reports that aired that day, cars were lined up before sunrise. The food bank planned to give away food to 6,000 families. What actually ended up happening?
Well, Karen, in this COVID-19 crisis, food banks literally across America have seen some unprecedented demand. We knew that many of the families had just spent their last paycheck dollar and they were hurting. We wanted to be there for them.
This is a drive-through distribution. So what does it mean when the day gets long and the day gets hot?
It gets pretty warm here. And when we showed up that day for the distribution, we had 2 shifts of volunteers, and it was going great. I actually was on site first thing, and then we're also delivering home boxes to seniors and shut-ins And as I left the distribution site, I got onto the interstate. And as I drove up the interstate in the opposite direction of our distribution, I just kept seeing cars and cars and cars. And I drove for miles and miles and miles. And that's when the panic started to set in. I had an idea what maybe 6,000 cars was going to look like, but I knew that I was seeing more than that. And so I called the warehouse to get more food delivered to the site. And I got back to our distribution and we were just finishing up the second shift and the volunteers were spent. I mean, Texas heat, Texas humidity, everybody was just tired and felt like they couldn't go on. But as I looked in the parking lot, there was probably 2,800 more families in their cars that had been waiting to get food. So we knew, obviously, we needed to hang in there. So I called our mayor and he sent backups. We had some Parks and Recreations staff that were able to come over and we just rallied. We planned on 6,000 families, but received 10,000 families, and we were able to get food to every family. But I was anxious, right? The last cars, I thought they've got to be tired and frustrated for waiting. But I was greeted with just smiles and gratitude from those remaining families that had waited to get the food assistance. Many of them recently laid off, furloughed, some of them waiting on their unemployment checks that hadn't arrived yet. I met so many families in that line that just reminded me that it could happen to any of us, that our community, it's a hardworking, you know, hospitality, lots of travel, tourism, hotel, transportation, theme parks like SeaWorld and Six Flags, all of those sectors are now shut down. There is no work to be had. It was heartbreaking.
So I know Spurs head coach Greg Popovich is on your advisory board. He's been a supporter of the food bank for decades. So how did this conference call happen? Did he reach out to you? Did you reach out to him?
Yeah, so I was keeping Pop up to speed on kind of what was happening, and he's always kind of checking in. And I tell you, the best thing that we needed was just a little bit of halftime coaching. And he said, put it together, Eric, and I'll be there. And it was that Monday that we set up for him to make the conference call with almost 300 folks. We had all of our staff, which is about 250 employees, lots of our volunteers. But everybody got an inspirational talk from Coach Pop, and they asked a little bit about why he enjoys coaching and how do you get through a period when you're up against a competitor that seems to have your number. You know, he just talked about how everybody was important. He's in an industry that's about a game and that we're doing something that was saving lives. And he said, every player knows about the rock and hammer. You take your hammer and you hit the rock and you hit the rock and you hit the rock and you just keep hitting the rock. And eventually that rock's going to break. And it's not that last hit that breaks the rock. It's all the hits that came before it. And so comparing that to our work, it's about just staying firm, just really being consistent, showing up. It's a box of groceries. It's a meal prepared. It's a child fed. It's a senior fed. And that we just need to keep hammering away.
Now, some of the questions that your staff asked were not necessarily related to the food bank's mission, right? I heard that there was a question about Game 6 of the 2013 finals.
Yeah, so, Pop was a gentleman, you know, like, hey, you guys, what do you want to talk about? And so, of course, lots of questions on players and, you know, who do you want to play horse with or not play horse with or how's so-and-so's three-pointer and what about this decision to bench Timmy in Game 6.
And you were out of the game in some key situations. Can you talk about Pop's substitution patterns and whether you agreed with him?
It's what we've done all year in that situation where we
and Pop answered it like this was the plan. We didn't think that, We needed that on the court at the moment, and we think it was the right decision. And it was just a real life example of you got to work the plan, and that's all any of us can do. I know in this time of the COVID-19 crisis, there's a lot of loss. I mean, people are losing loved ones, and people are losing their jobs. You know, people are losing nourishment. We just need to work our plan and try to minimize what this COVID-19 crisis takes from those that are struggling.
We are not nearly to the end of that crisis, and there will be more food distributions. Has your team been able to use Pop's advice and inspiration as you move forward?
They really enjoyed just that camaraderie and that simple friendship and expression of Pop. And, you know, he can be pretty hard-nosed and he can be pretty intimidating. But I think for that period of time, you know, he just, you know, really leaned in and it was fun. It was the perfect refueling, halftime break, distraction from the intensity of the work that we're engaged in. And obviously will help us through this season of struggle.
I hope you have the coach on speed dial in case you need inspiration in the coming weeks.
Yeah, no, I think he always makes himself available. I think that's what makes the San Antonio Spurs so great. You can't help but quickly become a Spurs fan once you really understand the organization of who they are, with the coaches and the players and the owners, and how they love our city and how they're using their influence to bring about a greater yield than just a championship. It's about really looking after the well-being of our city.
Eric, thanks so much for taking the time to speak with me.
No, thank you.
Eric Cooper is the president and CEO of the San Antonio Food Bank. We'll have more on how to support that organization and how to find and support your local food bank at onlyagame.org. I don't know about you, but one of my favorite pick-me-ups these past few weeks has been John Krasinski's web show, Some Good News.
For years now, I've been wondering, why is there not a news show dedicated entirely to good news? Well, desperately seeking my fix somewhere else, I reached out.
As much as I love good news, this next story is about Krasinski's first big hit, The Office, and one particular episode during that show's first season when Steve Carell's character, Michael Scott, challenged Dunder Mifflin's warehouse crew to a friendly game of basketball.
The last time I was down there, I noticed they'd put up a couple of hoops. And I play basketball every weekend. So I thought, this might be kind of fun.
It was blue collar versus white collar, and the losing team had to work on Saturday. But the game had bigger stakes for John Krasinski's character, Jim. It was his chance to impress Pam, the woman of his dreams, played by Jenna Fischer. One problem. Pam was engaged to warehouse tough guy Roy Anderson, played by actor David Denman.
Pam, you kind of have your foot in both camps here. Why don't you do the jump ball, okay?
Don't listen to him, Pam. Trust me. Tip it my way, you're sleeping in the car.
Okay, so now that you understand the basics, Nico Emack picks up the story from here.
In a real-life game, who do you think would win one-on-one?
John, 100%. 100%.
That's actor David Denman, who plays Roy from The Warehouse.
His whole family, they're giants, and they're all a basketball family. I think they coach ball. No, I'm not even going to pretend to play opposite, you know, that I would have a shot.
David never considered himself an athlete. Basketball was just something he did for fun as a kid.
All of my buddies were total jock heads. Like, you know, we would play basketball and break into gyms and go play ball. But, you know, I never really played it that competitively.
David says his earliest memory of the game is a sad one.
My parents split when I was a kid, and I lived in this, like, apartment complex. And the only place there was to, like, get out of the house was this basketball court. So I would go there by myself and just shoot hoops and, you know, like till the sun went down. And I did that a lot for many months.
As David got older, he found other avenues of expression. When he got to high school, he developed a passion for acting.
There was a kid in class who wanted to be an actor and was like, I'm going to go to Juilliard. And I was like, what is Juilliard?
David graduated from Juilliard in 1997 and began his career in film and TV. He landed roles in movies like The Replacements and Big Fish. In 2004, he got a call from a friend living in New York.
And he said, oh, you got to watch this show. The Office is so up your alley. And I hear they're doing an American version. You got to call your agent and get on that. So I watched it and I was like, gee, this is genius. And I called my agent and he at the time was like, what? Really? You want to do that? I said, yes. And then he was like, they're looking for improv comedians. And I'm like, look, dude, I went to Juilliard. It's not just because I studied Shakespeare doesn't mean I can't do improv comedy. You know, we had that class as well.
David got the part. And on March 24th, 2005, the first episode of The Office aired on NBC. By that point, they had already filmed Season 1, Episode 5, creatively titled Basketball. Season 1, Episode 5, The Warehouse versus The Office. How did you and your fellow cast members react to the idea of playing basketball for an entire episode?
Well, we were excited because everyone was stuck in the office. So all of a sudden, we got to be in the warehouse. There was already a basketball, like, hoop in the parking lot, I think, that John used to always play on. And Brian.
Brian Baumgartner, who plays the slow-talking accountant, Kevin Malone.
At least once a year, I like to bring in some of my Kevin's famous chili.
Brian Baumgartner is, like, ridiculously good at basketball. That guy can shoot all day long. They were filming him, like, just shooting, like, three after three after three. I mean, like, he did, like, 15 in a row or something crazy.
David says the actors were always encouraged to improvise on set. But for most of the basketball scenes, a stunt coordinator was brought in to choreograph, like when Roy elbows Jim in the face.
Whoa, 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 foul, naked aggression. Oh, that is, you're right, Jim, suck it up.
The sad part about it is, in reality, he really did get hit in the face. I elbowed him. We worked on the beat of me, you know, faking and turning, but he got a little close and my elbow went up a little higher, and the adrenaline of the situation, you know, everything ends up oftentimes not working out exactly how you plan it. And it was just way too close. And I caught him on the lip, busted his lip up. He's bleeding. That's all real blood. And they're like, continue filming. And at a certain point, John's like, guys, I'm bleeding. Like, really? Can we stop filming and, like, stop this? And they had to shoot, like, they were supposed to shoot their first poster, you know, of the, what the show was going to be that next Saturday. And he got his lip busted in half, thanks to me. So I don't think John liked me too much the first couple of years.
After another foul, Steve Carell's character tries to end the game early.
Well, let's just say whoever was ahead won.
That was you.
It was us, really? I didn't know. I guess you guys work on Saturday. Your face.
No, I'm not coming in on Saturday.
Yeah, this isn't happening.
How did you approach the role? And in particular, the role of such a, you know, to be frank, scumbag.
Yeah. I always like to try to find, you know, the other side of the character, you know. Things just didn't quite work out for him the way he had planned. And so I found, like, a little empathy for that.
Later that day, Roy and Pam leave the office. Roy taunts Jim one last time.
Look at Larry Bird. Larry Legend.
Yeah, he's pretty good, huh? Yeah, let's get you into a tub.
Yeah, let's get you into a tub.
The camera stays on Jim. He's devastated watching the woman of his dreams leave with Roy. As a fan of the show, I felt for him. Luckily for everyone, Jim and Pam end up together in the end. Except
everyone forgets the fact that Pam cheated on Roy. Let's not forget who the cheaters are and who the bad people are in this, okay? Everyone always says, you know, why'd you do Jim like that? No, he did me like that. I had nothing to do with anything that went down other than being a numbskull.
People forget.
People forget. Pam is the cheater.
In real life, David Denman and John Krasinski are good friends. The pair co-starred in the movie 13 Hours. They were together at Game 7 of the Stanley Cup Final, cheering for the Bruins against who else but Jenna Fischer and her St. Louis Blues.
That's reporter Nico Emack with a story that first aired last June. And even though we didn't get to talk with John Krasinski for Nico's story, we're still huge fans of Some Good News. In case you've missed it, we'll have links at onlyagame.org. Perry Utz has been a jockey for 47 years. He started when he was 19.
It hurts harder now. Pain is a lot more intense, it seems like, now than it was back then.
That's coming up. And remember, you can follow us on Facebook and Twitter at OnlyAGameNPR. I'm Karen Given. Next week on Only a Game, a gymnast who spoke out against abuses in her sport and was not believed years before the crimes of Larry Nassar came to light. But now it's time for Charlie Pierce and the week's news. Hi, Charlie.
Hi, Karen.
Okay, here we go. With the first pick in the 2020 draft, the Cincinnati Bengals select Joe Burrow, quarterback, LSU.
The NFL draft had a little less fanfare this year. That was no surprise. Nor was Joe Burrow going at number one. Will he be a good fit in Cincinnati?
Yeah, he will. I mean, he's a local kid. He's the obvious first pick. He had one of the great seasons in the history of college football. And this was as inevitable as anything could be.
We were not deprived of one of our most cherished draft traditions, thanks to Bud Light Seltzer, a product I would never have known existed if not for this commercial. Were you happy to see the annual booing of Roger Goodell?
Well, yeah, because no one deserves being booed more. But I think the the attempt to humanize the commissioner through this virtual draft was not successful. He was pretty much the same stiff we've all known and loved all these years.
Yeah, I mean, in the commercial, he's like petting a dog. He looks like a real person. Then in the actual draft, he kind of looks like a robot.
Yeah, and having the multi-screen behind him where he tried to talk to those people was just not working.
After an investigation that's dragged on since January, Major League Baseball has finally dropped the hammer on the Boston Red Sox, or maybe I should say dropped the feather, because I don't really think suspending the replay operator and docking a second-round draft pick is going to do the team in. Do you?
No, they really threw the pamphlet at them. You know, Alex Cora got punished, but he got punished for what he did in Houston, not what he did in 2018 managing the Red Sox, if anything. I feel bad for the replay guy because he's going to take all the weight for it. To me, this always has been just gamesmanship. I don't know what the gigantic scandal is here.
It really feels to me at this point that Major League Baseball just wants this whole thing to go away.
Major League Baseball would like people to remember there's Major League Baseball, which is going to be, you know, so that's going to be up in the air for a while.
After 33 years as the women's basketball coach at Notre Dame, Muffet McGraw has announced her retirement. She says that being forced to take time away from coaching these last few weeks has given her time to reflect. The Fighting Irish made 24 consecutive NCAA tournament appearances under McGraw. Not a bad career.
She's a terrific advertisement for women's sports. She's a great advertisement for the success of Title IX. She's one of my favorite people in the world. She's already a Hall of Famer, and now she gets to enjoy the rest of her life. She's going to become a speaker. I know she's going to be an advocate. She's not going away. She's just not going to coach anymore.
Tokyo Olympics organizers and the IOC are at odds over who should cover the costs of postponing the games to 2021. According to a government audit, the country has already spent almost $20 billion in public funds. The delay will cost Japan $2 to $6 billion more. Will any sane politician ever back an Olympic bid after this debacle?
You know, we've talked for years about just find a permanent site.
Yeah.
Put the Olympics there and get the IOC out of the international bribery business, because sooner or later this was going to happen. And it's hard to argue with the Japanese. I mean, they didn't have much of a call on this. It had to happen. And, you know, I mean, if they can't, you know, make some sort of modus vivendi on who's going to pay for the postponement, then neither the IOC nor the organizers are worth a damn.
And finally, Charlie, to avoid boredom during this COVID-19 crisis, Italian soccer team Pescara asked kids to design a new kit for when games resume. And I'm going to let you describe the winning entry because it is spectacular.
I'll tell you, young Luigi D'Agostino has got a future.
The shirt has a rainbow on it and a dolphin hitting a soccer ball with his nose. I would be very proud to own one of these things, to be perfectly honest with you.
Absolutely.
It is absolutely gorgeous.
Charlie Pierce is the guest editor of the Best American Sports Writing 2019, and he joins us each week at this time on Only a Game. Thanks, Charlie.
Thank you, Karen.
Have you subscribed to the Only a Game podcast yet? It's the best way to make sure you never miss a second of our show. You can find it on Apple, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. Normally, the Kentucky Derby is held the first Saturday in May, and on that day, roughly 150,000 spectators from all over the world put on their finest seersucker suits and spring hats and sardine themselves into the stands at Churchill Downs. It's exactly the opposite of social distancing, so it's no wonder that the race is now postponed until the fall. Our next story is about a jockey who's never raced in the Kentucky Derby or the Belmont Stakes or the Preakness, but he's stuck with the sport longer than almost anyone else. Here's reporter Ann Marshall.
On January 29th, 2006, Perry Utes was racing at Turfway Park in northern Kentucky on the back of a horse named Finder's Chance. He was in second place, traveling at about 40 miles per hour, when suddenly the horse collapsed. Perry and the horse hit the ground hard. Hours later, 50-year-old Perry was listening to a doctor tell him he had broken his arm and five vertebrae.
And he said that that my jockey days were over. He said, if you go down one more time, you probably wind up paralyzed, you know, because I'd done broke it too many times. And I looked him right in the eye and said, you know, I said, I've been doing this already 30 years, I guess. And I said, you can get paralyzed and you're 18 years old. It ain't because you're 50. I said, so I'll let you know when it's time.
Being a jockey is all Perry Utes has ever wanted to do. He wasn't a thrill seeker or a daredevil as a kid, but he grew up in small town Arkansas with a gaggle of cousins nearby. One of them, Early Fires, became a Hall of Fame jockey in 2001. Most of Early's eight brothers also worked in the horse industry. One day, fifth-grade Perry Utes sat at his desk. He was the kid whose feet still couldn't quite touch the floor. His assignment? Write about what you want to do when you grow up.
Well, this was the first year when my cousin Early, when he started riding. This was 1965. And I got to hearing stories about him and stuff, and I got to thinking, well, that'd be a really cool job because I liked horses already. And I was small, and that's what I wrote about. I wanted to be a jockey. And then a couple years went by, and I never thought about it again. And then I think I was 17. I was too young to get a job in a factory or anything. And my cousins called me up, and I think it was like a week later after I graduated, and they said, hey, you want to come up to Chicago? No, we'll teach you how to get on horses and make a jockey out of you. And I jumped on it, and I was there the next day.
Perry arrived at Arlington Park in Chicago very green. Most of his horse experience came back in Arkansas from his pet Shetland pony named Smokey. He started mucking stalls and walking horses around the barns. He graduated to galloping thoroughbreds. His horsemanship was improving, his confidence too. Maybe in a few months he would be racing. Then in the summer of 1972, he turned 18 and had to register for the draft.
I was nervous because I didn't know what was going to happen because Vietnam War was still going on. They always said the little guys had to be the tunnel rats over there in Vietnam, and I didn't want to do that. You know, go in there with nothing but a flashlight and a pistol, and you know, and they said rats as big as dogs over there. So I was fretting every day until I had to go down there to get my physical. Well, when I jumped on the scales, I weighed 95 pounds, and a guy looked at me and laughed and said, "We got backpacks way more than you do."
Too small for a soldier, but for a jockey, he was perfect. 5'1", strong and wiry. Perry moved from Chicago to Hot Springs, Arkansas, following his cousins from track to track. In the spring of 1973, he was ready to race. He headed for a small track near Cincinnati, then called Beulah Park. Perry's second day of racing, April 2nd, 1973, was biting cold, gray, and rainy. Perry loaded into the starting gate on a horse named Ray Blue.
The thing that I can remember most for is when I crossed the finish line, I kind of looked around both sides, and there's nobody around. I said, "I think I just won." And it was like slow motion. You know, it was happening in slow motion, not in real life. And I thought that was a pretty good thrill.
Perry was hooked.
I think I rode 9 the second day and won 2. The very second day I rode. So I got to thinking this was easy. Man, I'm going to be another Willie Shoemaker. This job's really easy. And the meet went on, and I was winning a lot of races. I was leading rider, first meet I ever rode at Beulah Park. I look back at it now, I couldn't spell horse, much less be a jockey. But, you know, I got lucky, got on a bunch of good horses, and that's the way it went.
Perry Utz is a good jockey, and it's not just luck. It's his dedication. True story, his youngest son was born at 10 a.m., and he was at the track by 12:30 to run races. His wife works in the barns at racetracks around Cincinnati where they live, so she gets it. Another true story, Perry eats the same thing every day so he can maintain his ideal jockey weight. Coffee and a roll in the morning, half a sandwich at lunch, and a meat and potatoes dinner. He's at the barns ready to exercise horses before sunrise every morning. Jockeys don't get paid for that morning work, but showing up every day helps you connect with trainers and earn mounts on solid, fast horses come race time. Still, dedication doesn't guarantee longevity, not in this sport. Perry learned that quickly. It was May of 1977, long before Perry had started a family. He was living with his cousin, Jackie Fires, who was Early's younger brother. Perry and Jackie had been best friends ever since their childhoods in Arkansas. One day, Perry finished his morning workouts before Jackie and headed home.
About an hour later, they called me and they said that Jackie had got hurt. And they said, "It's pretty bad." They said, "You need to get down here to the track." So I went down, and he was still in the ambulance, and he said he couldn't feel his legs, you know.
21-year-old Jackie had been galloping as last horse of the morning. Nothing about this horse indicated it was weak or clumsy, but racehorses can be unpredictable and uncoordinated, like a teenager who hasn't quite grown into their body. For some reason, that morning, Jackie's horse clipped its front legs while galloping. Both the horse and Perry's cousin fell. The horse rolled over Jackie.
And we went to the hospital. I rode an ambulance with him. They said, you know, did x-rays and all that, and said, yeah, he'd severed his spinal cord, and they was going to have to operate on him. And I had to call his mom, and he had a fluid building around his heart, you know, and he's thinking he's going to die. So he got the operation. It went pretty good, and he made it through. He said, just, you know, go on about your business and do your job. Don't worry about it. You know, it can happen to anybody. He said, just don't think about it, you know, so... He was that kind of guy.
It sounds impossible. How do you watch someone you love become paralyzed and mentally set it aside? But the next morning, Perry woke up and went to the track to exercise horses.
You have to block out the danger. You got to be able to do that. I mean, you do this 7, 8, 9 times a day. You know, if you sit around and thought about it, you couldn't ride. There's no way. And some jockeys, when they get hurt, they can't block that out anymore. Through the years, I've been lucky that I can just tunnel it right out. I mean, I've been in a race before with a guy running head and head, come down the stretch. He went down, 12-horse field, 10 of them run over him, killed him right there on the spot, went and rode the next day.
Perry's not callous. He just really loves his job. To keep at it, he survives the trauma. When injured, he asks, how soon can I get back? And there have been a lot of injuries. At least 40 broken bones, including 11 vertebrae. During one race, his horse made a sudden move and Perry slid off. His horse kicked his left eye socket, shattering it. Actually, he's shattered that left eye socket twice. And this past summer, he was heading toward the starting gate when his horse's bridle broke. The horse took off, and with nothing to hold on to, Perry slammed to the ground, tearing his rotator cuff.
It hurts harder now. I mean, pain is a lot more intense, it seems like, now than it was back then. And I think when you're young, you're kind of like your bones are elastic. You know, you're kind of like a rubber ball. When you hit the ground, you just bounce around. But yeah, when you hit the ground now, it hurts.
So why not retire? With 51,218 races, the only jockey with more starts is Russell Bays, a now-retired jockey out of California who started more than 53,000 times. Perry knows at his current rate he doesn't have enough years in him to pass Bays, so he had to set other goals.
And Emmy's Candy has the lead 2.5 lengths to the good.
When I first met Perry in 2016, he said he'd retire when he reached 7,000 wins.
Career win number 7,000 for Perry Utes.
He did it aboard a horse named Emmy's Candy in September 2018. And the wins are still coming.
And even after 47 years, I still get that same thrill. Even like the first day that I started riding, I get that thrill every time I win. I mean, it's just unbelievable.
When someone suggests retirement, he remembers what one of America's most celebrated jockeys once told him.
Pat Day was telling me, he said, when you don't get that thrill, he said, that's when it's time to quit.
For most jockeys, an impressive career lasts 20, maybe 30 years. Injury or burnout forces many to call it quits. Perry's in his 47th year of racing. It will likely be his age that finally steals that thrill of racing from him. He'll turn 66 years old in July, old enough to start collecting Social Security. When he does stop racing, Perry's not sure what he'll do next. He's never given retirement much thought.
That's reporter Ann Marshall. Tracks in Indiana, Ohio, and Kentucky, where Perry Utes typically races, are still waiting to see if they will be allowed to open this spring and summer without fans in the stands.